thank you. Is this the official recording device, or is this just this individual's recording device?
No, it's the official.
This is the official recording device, right?
I don't know whether they cut out the bits at the beginning if it starts.
if I start rambling, or I hope so.
The edits, the director's cut.
I'm worried, actually, that today's lecture is too short and that the third one is too long. I don't know if that would be... It's a little awkward for me to suddenly say, if I finish early, to say, well, I'll start on the next...
Well, there are some constraints.
Yeah, no, I think what I'll do is I just won't be able to show everything in the third lecture that I had really intended, but that's, you know, that's all right. I have to make a choice as to what to show, so...
Mm-hmm. Well, the only thing I'd recommend is... wherever you've got your sub-lectures, making sure that they have time to ask questions. And
okay. We're not talking about... it's a matter of minutes here and there. I hope. Sometimes I've horribly misestimated. More often I run on horribly, but haul me off the stage when necessary.
We've got a big hook.
Yeah. Sometimes, you know, it's very easy. You just lose track of time sometimes.
You cut up to an hour and 15 minutes.
Okay. No, there's no way I'm going that long. So.
Yeah. And I mean, so there's plenty of time for questions and interaction during the lecture. And
that's good. That's great. And Nigel was telling me last night that this seems like a relatively talkative, interactive bunch. Okay, good.
There seems to be something worth asking a question about.
So they've been Pavlovian training or something.
So yeah, if you haven't collected them already, there are slides. I think that's the final set of slides that you'll then have. So you have both Glenn's
So anyway, yeah, it's Bayesian limits and discovery, multivariate. I was looking around through my mails actually this last week to try to see if we actually agreed on a set of topics, and I don't think we had actually. It was kind of just.
I think you're in charge, right?
Right. Okay. I was hoping that people would just trust me on this one.
The degree of overlap with the other. You know, the only issue would be if there is some.
Oh right. Yeah.
But they've always seen these combined analyses, right?
Right. Right. Right.
And understanding what actually was required. So, if I can introduce you.
Okay.
So, good morning, everybody. Those who've made it. This is Glenn Cowan. Glenn, amongst other things, is a key member of the Atlas Statistics Forum. So, he's a member of Atlas, but he also knows a lot about statistics. I think there are a few questions that you could ask in the statistics area that Glenn wouldn't be able to answer. Whether you would understand the answer, I don't know, but it's a pleasure to welcome Glenn. He's going to talk about statistical methods in particular physics.
Great. Thanks very much, Tony, and thanks to the organizers for inviting me. It's a great pleasure to come and talk to you all. As advertised, I'm going to talk about statistical methods, and as I have only three lectures, I've decided to organize this in the following way. Here's the outline that I've chosen. In the first lecture today, I want to talk about an introduction to Bayesian statistics. Now, I'm going to guess that many of you are involved right now in doing an analysis or preparation for LHC analyses, and so you're surely comfortable with certain statistical tools. But Bayesian statistics is not the kind of thing that people usually see, at least not right away. And so I want to take this opportunity to tell people about what Bayesian statistics is and to contrast it with the usual frequentist statistics. And then in the second lecture tomorrow, I'll talk about setting limits and making a discovery. Setting limits, of course, is what we were involved in doing mainly at LEP because we didn't really discover anything new. And hopefully that will become irrelevant at the LHC and we'll just focus on making discoveries. But in either case, the statistical arguments that one has to make, I think, have to be laid out carefully. And so that's what we'll talk about tomorrow. And then finally, on the third lecture, I want to talk about multivariate methods. That is to say, for every event, you measure some number of quantities, potentially large number of quantities, and in that multidimensional space, you want to be able to try to select out events of interest and reject background events, or to try to test in some way as to whether some new class of events is present, such as supersymmetric events. And so we'll look at this question of event selection as a statistical test. There are a few important theorems related to that. And then I'll talk about some of the multivariate classifiers that could be regarded as part of statistics, or it could be regarded as part of neural computing and machine learning. Some of these I think you've probably heard of: neural networks, boosted decision trees, things like support vector machines are quite new, and I'm afraid I have too much material for this third lecture. We're not going to really, I think, get to all of that, but it will be in the overheads that you will have access to. Okay, so to start off today, I want to begin by just making some general comments as to how probability is involved in an experimental data analysis. So recall what we're always doing is to, say, collide together particles, protons or whatever, and something comes out, and we observe events of a certain type. And that, of course, is all ingrained in our minds as the basic unit of data that we have to deal with, is the event. But, of course, in many other disciplines, it's completely different. If you're a radio astronomer, you might measure a voltage as a function of time, and then suddenly your analysis problem looks completely different. But we always have in mind that we have a number of events. And for each one, we measure certain characteristics, like particle momenta, or the number of jets, or the energies of the jets. And of course, because the theories do not predict on an event-by-event basis what's going to happen, we only get predictions for distributions of these properties. And furthermore, these predictions are not fully specified, but rather the theories involved always involve some number of free parameters, some number of constants whose values are not themselves predicted by the theory, but which have to be inferred by comparing those predictions to the data. And so the tasks that we have in data analysis involve estimating the values of these free parameters, such as the particle masses and couplings and so forth, then quantifying the uncertainty in those parameter estimates, and then finally testing to what extent the predictions of a theory stand in agreement with the data. And to the extent that you say that they don't, say that the data might not agree with the standard model, that would be taken as an indication of some new discovery. Okay, so there are various elements of uncertainty that enter into that exercise. And, of course, the first one I've just mentioned is that the theory itself is not deterministic. The theory only predicts probabilities for outcomes. Even if you had a deterministic theory, however, if you happen to be dealing with a partial problem where quantum effects are not important, there are always going to be random measurement errors that would be present without quantum effects in any realistic experiment built on a finite budget and a finite time scale. So those would be things that you could know in principle, but due to limitations of time and cost, you're never in a realistic experiment going to know them all. And so the idea is to quantify those different elements of uncertainty using probability. Now, probability, or some intuitive notion of probability, must have been known even to cavemen, but I think the mathematical formulation of probability, of course, was much later, maybe in the 17th century. But in fact, it wasn't until the 20th century that there was an axiomatic formulation of probability in terms of set theory by Kolmogorov, and I just wanted to introduce that quickly. It goes like this. If you consider some set S, which is traditionally called the sample space, that contains some elements, I'll call the various subsets of S, A, B, and so forth, you just write down three axioms that will define our probability function. And because this is an abstract definition, I don't even have to insist on what the elements of this sample space have to be. But just to give an example, obviously, they will represent the possible outcomes of a repeatable experiment, or they could represent other things as well. Just to have one example in mind. And so you say that for all subsets of the sample space, we assign a real number greater than or equal to zero. That's the first axiom. Then the sample space itself is one of the subsets, and the probability that you assign to the sample space is equal to 1. And then if you consider, the third axiom is a little more complicated, if you consider two subsets which are disjoint, that is to say, their intersection, null set, then the probability that you associate with the union of those two subsets is equal to the sum of the two corresponding probabilities. So that's it. From those three axioms, you can get all of the normal properties of a probability function that you would ordinarily expect. Except for one, and that is the following. There are cases where I mentioned that this sample space can represent the set of possible outcomes of an experiment, of an observation. There can be cases where you want to say that actually you know that the outcome is going to be within some restricted subset of the originally specified set. That is to say, you might want to know what is the probability of outcome A given that you know that it will be within B. So B somehow restricts the originally specified set of possible outcomes. That's what's called a conditional probability, P of A given B. And that is defined as the probability of the intersection of A and B. So that means that the intersection in the set theory language you can think of as the AND operation, right? The outcome has to be both in A and in B, divided by the probability of B. So that definition, of course, only holds if P of B is non-zero. And that has to also be taken as a definition. It cannot be derived from the three original axioms. But given all that, that's pretty much all we need to write down for probability. Except the following. I haven't insisted on what the meanings of the elements of the sample space are, and I haven't even specified a rule that tells you how to compute numerical values for these probabilities. That goes beyond the axiomatic definition of probability. You need to somehow interpret the probability in some way. And so there are two main ways of interpreting probability that are used in science, and those two ways lead to two competing schools of statistics. And these schools have been at loggerheads. They've been somehow competing or debating with each other for hundreds of years now, and there's actually been a substantial amount of controversy between these two schools of statistics, and that's one of the things that I want to try to discuss in this first lecture. Now, the first interpretation of probability that I'm sure we're all familiar with is that of a relative frequency. That is to say that the elements of the sample space represent possible outcomes of an observation which, in principle, can be repeated an arbitrarily large number of times. And the probability that you associate with a subset A is simply the fraction of times that the outcome is in A in the limit that the number of observations becomes very large. So when you write this limit, n goes to infinity, the mathematicians always laugh because from the standpoint of a proper mathematical limit, this really doesn't make much sense. How can you consider repeating an experiment an infinite number of times? But nevertheless, in the normal Copenhagen interpretation of quantum mechanics, that is the type of probability that people have in mind. And certainly in our business, where we're scattering particles, there doesn't seem to be any particular limit to the number of times that we can collide two protons together. So this frequentist interpretation of probability seems particularly appropriate for the type of work that we do. And yet, there are other things for which frequentist probability really is inappropriate. And when you talk about probability in daily language, very often this type of a limiting frequency is not really what we have in mind. And that leads to the one of the second major interpretations of probability, which is called subjective probability. And in this interpretation, the elements of the sample space are hypotheses. And by hypothesis here, I simply mean a statement which is either true or false. Right? And in this context, the sample space is very often called the hypothesis space. The idea here is that the probability associated with one of the elements of the hypothesis space is simply the degree of belief that that hypothesis is true. It is a subjective degree of belief. And so the first thing is that you might think, well, in a scientific analysis, surely we should be objective. Surely there's no room for bringing subjective judgments into a scientific analysis. On the other hand, there can certainly be instances where it is appropriate. Now, we'll get to that in just a bit. So, both interpretations are consistent with the abstract Kolmogorov axioms that I wrote down. So, both are justified in being called probability functions. They both obey the Kolmogorov axioms and the definition of conditional probability. And I think it's fair to say that in particle physics, the frequency interpretation is most useful. But subjective probability can, for example, provide more natural treatment of those phenomena which for which a repetition of an observation makes no real sense. And systematic uncertainties are a typical example. These are things that are uncertain, but that uncertainty does not involve a variation upon repetition of any experiment. Or I could ask, for example, what is the probability that the Higgs boson exists? Well, the answer is either yes or no. And that answer will not change upon any repetition of any experiment. I may not know whether the answer is yes or no, but whatever the answer is, it has nothing to do with repetition of some experiment. Okay. So, regardless of whether we interpret the probability as a degree of belief or a relative frequency or in some other way, a probability has to obey an important theorem called Bayes' theorem. So that's what I want to derive right now. And this, I should say, that I've mentioned that there's a controversy involving these two schools of statistics, one of which is Bayesian statistics. But the controversy has nothing to do with Bayes' theorem. Bayes' theorem is completely straightforward and easy to derive, and so let's just do so. I wrote down the definition of conditional probability as P of A given B is the probability of the intersection of A and B divided by P of B. But A and B are just labels. I can therefore write down the conditional probability of B given A, and that is therefore the probability of the intersection of B and A divided by P of A. But now if you think about it, in the languages set theory, the intersection of A and B and the intersection of B and A refer to exactly the same thing. There's no difference between the order. So therefore, the probability of those two subsets, A intersect B and B intersect A, must be equal. And so if I simply solve that equation for that numerator and solve that equation for that numerator and set them equal, I get that equation. And so there's certainly nothing mysterious about that. That relates the probability of A given B. It says it's equal to the probability of B given A times the probability of A divided by the probability of B. And so that's an ancient theorem, ancient in the sense of 1763. It was famously published posthumously. Apparently, Bayes himself had some doubts as to whether or not it really all made sense. And some friend of his published it a couple of years after he died. It's interesting. I'm sure you could Google for that right away and find some sort of web version of this paper. And it's interesting to look at just to see how absolutely incomprehensible the language is. I don't think you'd even guess that it was talking about probability here. But, right, so that's Bayes' theorem. Now, very often this denominator here, P of B, comes in just as a normalization constant, and it can be very often to have another formula to rewrite that, and that is the following. That comes from this thing called the law of total probability. And the idea is that if that square represents the sample space, and suppose that red guy is this then the more restrictive subset which is going to be the condition in the conditional probability. I'm interested in A, probability of A given, say, that B. Now, in many cases, it can be possible to subdivide the initial sample space into smaller subsets. I'll label them here A sub I. All right. So, and it looks sort of looks like it's overlapping tiles, but I mean these things to be disjoint. All right. So these just are disjoint bits of the full sample space. And the overlap between B and, say, one of the AIs is that yellow guy there. Now, if you will recall the third Kolmogorov axiom, it said that if you have disjoint subsets, then the corresponding probabilities simply add. Right? And so the visual picture here is that these disjoint bits that are inside B, sorry, the small bits which are inside B are also disjoint. They don't intersect. And so therefore, the probability of B is simply the probability that I associate with that B intersect AI plus that B intersect AJ plus that B intersect J AK or whatever. And you simply add up all those bits. So that's the visual derivation of this formula that I want to get at. And here's just the gobbledygook that gets at that. It just says B is then the union of all of those things inside it. And so therefore, P of B is the probability of that union. And that is simply, by the Kolmogorov axiom, the sum of the individual probabilities. And then if you look back at the definition of conditional probability, you see that P of B intersect AI, that's like the numerator in the definition of the conditional probability P of B given AI. So that can simply be rewritten in that form. And that equation there is sometimes called the law of total probability and can be used to rewrite the denominator of Bayes' theorem. So that's the form of Bayes' theorem that we will usually encounter. Okay, so let's keep going. Let me say just a few words on the general philosophy of these two schools of statistics, frequentist and the one using subjective probability. So the general philosophy behind frequentist statistics is the following, is that you only associate probabilities with the data. Right? You don't talk about probabilities of a hypothesis unless that hypothesis represents something which itself can be repeated. That is to say, the hypothesis that a specific particle is an electron would not find place in this frequentist statistics, because that is either true or false. On the other hand, if you had a large collection of particles and you wanted to then regard that hypothesis as the outcome of a repeatable observation, then you could. But in any case, probabilities such as the probability that the Higgs boson exists, or the probability that some constant of nature is located between two fixed limits, those probabilities are either zero or one, but you don't know which. So it's not obvious how, given that restriction, the frequentist probability is going to be of any use in telling us what theories are good and what theories are bad. And the basic idea is that frequentist statistics tells you what to expect only about hypothetical repeated observations. And so therefore, the preferred theories are simply those theories for which our data would be considered usual. That is to say, if a theory predicts a high probability to get data which is similar to the data we got, then that would be a good theory. So that's the basic idea behind frequentist statistics, and that's what I only wanted to sort of skim over here, because I actually want to focus on Bayesian statistics in this lecture. The basic philosophy behind Bayesian statistics is the following. In Bayesian statistics, you extend the interpretation of probability to include this degree of belief. Right? That is to say, you use subjective probability for hypotheses. Now, data also is involved in this, of course, and so the frequentist interpretation of probability is also used in Bayesian statistics. And the basic idea behind a Bayesian analysis is to use Bayes' theorem in order to obtain the probability for a given hypothesis, say a given theory or a given model, given the outcome of your experiment through Bayes' theorem. So I will use H here to refer to some hypothesis. That could be a hypothesized theory, or it could be the hypothetical value of some parameter. And very often I'll just use X here to represent the data, that is to say, whatever collection of numbers characterizes the outcome of the experiment. So Bayes' theorem says that the probability of the hypothesis given the data is equal to the probability of the data given the hypothesis times the probability of the hypothesis. And then I've rewritten that law of total probability here in the denominator symbolically as an integral rather than a sum. But what has to happen here is that you sum over all possible hypotheses, and that ensures that this probability on the left-hand side is normalized to unity. If one were to, you can easily see that if you integrate both numerator, both left and right-hand side over all hypotheses, it gives one, right? Because then you'd have the same thing in the numerator and the denominator. Okay, so let's look at this equation a little bit more. This term here, the probability of the data given the hypothesis, that is what is called the likelihood. Right? And that construct enters into both frequentist and Bayesian statistics. And typically what you do is you evaluate that function with the data that you got, and you look at it as a function of the hypothesis. So if the hypothesis is a parameter, the likelihood function would be a function of that parameter. All right, so the likelihood function enters into both frequentist and Bayesian methods. But then how about the probability of the hypothesis? This means the probability of the hypothesis without regard to the data. That is to say, before you saw the data. This is what is called the prior probability for the hypothesis. And so it is supposed to be your subjective degree of belief as to how true the hypothesis is before you did the experiment. And so this is where it gets a bit tricky, and there is no unique recipe for specifying that quantity. So, right, so I should pause and discuss that point for a second. People would normally see that point and say, well, if there's no recipe on how to get the prior probability and you need it, well, then surely it's not completely obvious what use this tool can be. But the idea is to look at this theorem as telling you how a given set of prior beliefs should evolve in the light of the data. So this Bayes' theorem really represents a sort of learning, and it has a sort of if-then character. It says that if your degree of belief about the hypothesis was specified by some function, pi of h, and then you did an experiment which gave you some information as to whether or not that hypothesis was true or false, then Bayes' theorem is telling you how your degree of belief should be updated in the light of the data. Right, so there's no golden rule for specifying these prior probabilities, but one has to keep in mind this sort of if-then character of Bayes' theorem. So again, this can provide a more natural treatment of non-repeatable phenomena, such as systematic uncertainties, things like what is the probability, for example, that the first person to fly to Mars will return alive? Right? Well, it's either going to be true or false, but you can't repeat that experiment. That's only going to be a one-off. Right? So there are certain things for which a repetition of an experiment simply doesn't make sense, and this type of degree of belief probability is really more appropriate. Now, on this, I want to focus on systematic errors for just a little bit, because that's an important class of uncertainty where this idea of repetition is not fully appropriate. So let me say a little bit about what we mean by statistical versus systematic errors. Now, a statistical error really addresses the issue of how much would the result fluctuate upon repetition of the measurement. And to quantify that, that implies some set of assumptions that defines the outcome of the measurement. It is somehow says if you were to repeat the measurement many times, what would be the spread of outcomes. Now, the systematic error is another source of uncertainty, but it has to do exactly with the uncertainty in those assumptions. That is to say, it is the uncertainty in the model which tells you how much your outcomes should be distributed upon repetition. And that model uncertainty can enter into a number of different places. Obviously, in the models that we deal with, there is an underlying theory, say the standard model, but then you have to actually use that standard model to make a prediction for a particular reaction, say a proton goes to something. And that is never going to be the exact model prediction. It will be implemented using, say, perturbation theory to some limited order. It will involve parton density functions that are not completely known. And then there will be hadronization processes that are only modeled in some approximate way. So there is model uncertainty in the sense of theoretical uncertainty in extracting an exact prediction for a reaction. Beyond that, of course, we send the particles through some complicated detector. And the idea is that even though you have some horribly complicated Monte Carlo model to describe a particle physics detector, it's not going to be completely accurate. So there are various sorts of theoretical uncertainty or model uncertainty. And the idea is that these sources of uncertainty not vary upon repetition of the measurement. They can manifest themselves as uncertain values of calibration constants or efficiencies and so forth. And so here's just a symbolic part of a model. That is to say, this is something that your model is trying to predict as a function of something else. That could be a calorimeter response as a function of some sort of input energy. And your model might be that the thing that you're trying to predict varies in some simple way as a function of this control variable. But the true response might be more complicated, might have more complicated behavior. Now you might say, all right, well, if I think that the true response of the detector, say, is more complicated, then perhaps I could simply increase the number of adjustable parameters in my model, so that perhaps for some point in the enlarged parameter space of this model, it can approximate better the truth. And that is indeed the key to somehow covering systematic uncertainty, is to ensure that at least for some point in your model's parameter space, the distance between it and the truth can be neglected. But in doing so, what you find is that as you insert more and more adjustable parameters into the model, then the ability of that model to make firm predictions is degraded. Now, if you don't include these additional parameters, then your model has some systematic uncertainty. If you do include those additional parameters, then what you see is that systematic uncertainty can be converted effectively into a statistical uncertainty. The point I want to make here is that there is this connection between a systematic uncertainty and what we'll call nuisance parameters. That is to say, additional parameters that you need to insert into a model. These are not the parameters that you're interested in at the end of the day. Right? It's not the mass of the Higgs or the some coupling that you're trying to measure. These are constants whose values are necessary for a correct description of the data, but whose values at the end of the day you don't really care about. So nuisance parameters. Okay, so, yeah? Trying to get back to the slide. My arrow keys are going a little wonky. Hang on. Where was it? There.
Like you define systematic uncertainties in the model also. So here.
So what I meant to say is the following: is that suppose I took that as my model, all right? But suppose the truth was more complicated. Then I would say there would be a systematic uncertainty in that model, right? Because or a systematic error in that model, because the predictions of that model would not correspond exactly to the truth. On the other hand, if I took this more complicated model, right, then in some sense the systematic error is gone, because there can be a point in this model's parameter space for which the predictions of that more complicated model can be very, very close to the truth. Right? And so there I would say I have a systematic uncertainty. Here what I have is no systematic uncertainty, but a larger number of adjustable parameters. And what I want to argue, what I will show now in an example, is that as you include more adjustable parameters, you basically inflate the statistical uncertainties on the parameters of interest. But so there's a trade-off between the two. And it's not completely true that a certain uncertainty is always a systematic uncertainty or a statistical uncertainty. It can depend on how you model the experiment. It can depend on exactly what model assumptions you make. All right. Right. So now what I want to do is do a simple example that illustrates exactly that point. And the idea is the following. Is that suppose we consider just some data points, y versus x. So this is y plus or minus some error bar. All right. And each of these measurements is made for a specified value of some control variable x. So I've got xi, yi, sigma I. And what I want to assume now is that the measured values yi are independent, and they follow some Gaussian distribution. So I use n here to stand for a normal distribution. So the yi are Gaussian distributed. And the mean of that Gaussian distribution, mu of x, is some function of x. And then I want to assume that the variances of these random variables are some specified values, sigma I squared. But what I'm interested in is the mean value, all right, of each. That is to say, I can regard that as the true value of the quantity, and then the measured value departs from it because of some random effects. So the model that I have for this mean, mu of x, here contains two parameters, theta 0 and theta 1, right? It's just some straight line. And suppose, in this particular example, that the goal was to measure the offset. The goal was to measure this theta 0. And it may be that you didn't even know that this thing had any dependence on this variable x. And later, at some late stage of the game, somebody came on and said, well, actually, the measured value might depend on this variable x. And so you need to include some sort of slope parameter here. You don't really care about the value of that slope. You only care about getting the right value of the y-intercept. All right? But nevertheless, that has to be your model. All right? So now the normal way of doing this in the frequentist approach would be to write down the likelihood function. And so the likelihood function, recall, is the probability for the data given the model evaluated with the data that you got. Right? And in this case, I said that the measurements were all independent Gaussian distributed values. And so therefore, the likelihood function, which is a function of the two parameters theta 0 and theta 1, is simply the product of Gaussian terms. Okay? So here I've got the normal Gaussian distribution, and here I've got in the argument the measured value for the ith measurement minus the prediction for the ith measurement. Right? And the normal frequentist tool that you would apply in this case is the method of maximum likelihood, where you would say that the preferred values of the parameters are the values that maximize the likelihood. So that maximizes the probability to get data like the data that you got. So maximizing that function, normally, of course, you maximize the logarithm of that function. That converts that product into a sum, and it gets rid of the exponential. And so maximizing the likelihood amounts to minimizing this sum of squares, all right, which you can see if you just look at the one step of math. That sum of squares is simply minus 2 times the log of the likelihood function plus a constant term that doesn't depend on the parameters. And of course, that sum of squares is what we usually call the chi-squared. And so if you look in this theta 0 versus theta 1 plane, there will be some point in that plane for which the chi-squared is a minimum. And then the frequentist recipe for getting then the standard deviations of those, hang on, I'm going to say this right. There will be some point for which the chi-squared is a minimum. That point I will write as theta 0 hat and theta 1 hat. Okay, so the hats denote the estimators. These are not the true values of the parameters, but those are the values that I will use to estimate those values. I then have to ask the question, if I were to repeat the entire experiment many times with an independent data set each time, how much random fluctuation would I expect in the estimators, theta 0 hat and theta 1 hat? Right, that is what I get from the standard deviations of theta 0 hat and theta 1 hat. And the recipe in this game to get the standard deviations of theta 0 hat and theta 1 hat is to look at the contour in this parameter space where the chi-squared has increased by exactly one unit relative to its minimum. Right? And then you draw the tangent lines to that contour, and the distance between theta 0 hat and the tangent line there where the chi-squared has increased by 1, that gives you the standard deviation of theta 0 hat. Right? And so this picture immediately illustrates the problem of inserting too many nuisance parameters, because it shows you that, look, if theta 1 were not an adjustable parameter, but a known constant, then you can see that the amount that you would have to change the parameter to get the chi-squared to go up by 1 would only be that much. And that would then be the corresponding standard deviation of theta 0 hat. But because theta 1 is also an adjustable parameter, and because in this particular case the contour comes out tilted, then the uncertainty in theta 1, that is to say the standard deviation in theta 1 hat, affects the standard deviation of theta 0 hat. All right? So the correlations between these two estimators causes the standard deviation of the parameter of interest to increase. All right, so that's a very important point. If you go inserting too many additional nuisance parameters into your model, that then inflates the statistical uncertainty in the parameter of interest.
I don't understand. As long as these they are correlated, they are relevant, or you can get rid of them.
Sorry, I'm not sure what you mean.
You said if you include more nuisance parameters in the game, you get larger errors.
That's correct.
But as long as they are correlated, I can detect the correlation and I can get rid of it.
Well, you definitely detect the correlation in the sense that when you look at this contour, you see that it is tilted, and that is a sign of the correlation. But what does get rid of? How do you get rid of it? The point is that the recipe, which I haven't derived, but which I'm going to claim is true, is that the recipe for the standard deviation in theta 0 hat is given by the distance from there all the way over to that tangent line. Right, so you don't get rid of it. It's actually bigger. Yeah. And so this next slide simply illustrates what would happen if you indeed did have some prior information on this other parameter theta 1. Suppose you had a prior measurement of that parameter. Let's call that T1. And suppose T1 was an independent Gaussian distributed value centered about the true and unknown value theta 1. And it had some accuracy sigma T1, all right, some standard deviation sigma T1. Well, that would correspond to an additional Gaussian term in the full likelihood function. And when you then look at the log likelihood function, that would correspond to an additional term of this form in the chi-squared. So there would be the usual chi-squared, and then you would simply have a term of the form theta 1 minus T1 squared over this sigma T1 squared. And so thereby, including some additional information on the nuisance parameter, it squishes the ellipse in the vertical direction. And as a consequence, the amount that you have to go out from the center to get to that contour is decreased. Right? So the information on the nuisance parameter improves the accuracy on the parameter of interest. So all that was just my quick recap of the frequentist method so as to get into the Bayesian method, which is what I really want to discuss. So what we need to do is, so let me discuss now how to do the equivalent problem in the Bayesian. Now recall, in the Bayesian approach, you require prior probabilities. You need the probability for the parameters before you did the measure. Now, that is, in this case, that is going to be some joint probability density for the two parameters theta 0 and theta 1. Now, you have to first ask yourself, if I knew theta 1, would that have any impact on my uncertainty for theta 0? And vice versa. That's equivalent to the question as to whether or not the uncertainties are independent, which is equivalent to asking whether or not the thing would factorize into a function of theta 0 times a function of theta 1. In many cases, that might be true. In other cases, maybe it's not true. But let me assume in this case that the function factorizes, that is to say theta 0 and theta 1 are independent. Now, theta 0, this y-intercept is the parameter I was interested in, and so presumably before I did the measurement, I didn't know much about it, or else there wouldn't have been a point in doing the measurement. But let's suppose that this prior probability for theta 0 was some very broad probability density, and I will take the limit of that. I'll simply take it equal to a constant. Sometimes people take this constant to reflect prior ignorance, and this phrase prior ignorance is a pair of words that you can see very often in the description of these methods. I think that's fallen a bit out of favor because people have come to the realization that prior ignorance is not a well-defined, uniquely defined concept. But in any case, I want a prior for theta 0, a prior probability, which is very broad compared to the likelihood function. Now, how about for my prior probability for theta 1? Well, let me assume that, as in the previous overhead, I had some prior measurement of theta 1, this value t1, which I'm going to treat as a Gaussian distributed quantity with a certain standard deviation sigma t1. But here, this function is a little bit different. This now represents my degree of belief about where the parameter theta 1 lies, and so this is now a Gaussian in theta 1 centered about t1. Right? In the prior expression, that determined the likelihood function was a Gaussian for the measurement t1 centered about the true and unknown parameter theta 1. But because the Gaussian distribution is symmetric in those quantities, then it comes out to be the same function. Okay, so those are the prior probabilities. It's the same likelihood function as in the previous part, and so I can simply write down Bayes' theorem, which says that the posterior probability for the parameters in the light of the outcome of the measurement, these numbers y, is proportional to the likelihood, all right, that's the same likelihood as before, times the prior probabilities. And the prior probability here, I've just written this constant as pi sub 0, and there is the prior for the quantity theta 1. All right? Now, remember that I said that I'm only interested in the parameter theta 0, but what Bayes' theorem has given me is the probability for the full hypothesis, theta 0 and theta 1. So what I simply need to do is to take that joint probability density for those two parameters and integrate it over the unwanted parameter. All right, and that's what's called marginalizing a multi-parameter probability density. That you can do in Bayesian statistics, and there is no such corresponding operation in the frequentist approach. Yes? I'm taking it, yes, I took it to be a constant, that's right. Yeah, okay. So I think I see what you're getting at. And one of the problems is that we would like this probability density to be, if I integrate over all possible values of theta 0, it should integrate to unity. And if I take it to be a constant, then that appears to be a problem. And so that type of a probability density, where it's equal to a constant which could have an infinite range, is what is called an improper probability density. Now, that is not really a problem, because the prior probability always enters multiplied by the likelihood. And as long as the likelihood dies off to zero sufficiently quickly, then having that constant in there is not a problem. It's analogous to using like plane waves in quantum mechanics. In some, it's analogous to that. There can be other problems that I think we'll get to tomorrow where using improper prior probabilities really is a problem, but here it's not. Okay, I can say that, take it between some large range, right, and then take the limit where those edges go to infinity. Okay. Dennis, good question. All right, but now let me get onto this point again. If I have this joint density and I simply integrate it over the unknown, the unwanted parameter to give me the probability density of the parameter of interest, theta 0, given, that shouldn't be x. X here symbolically represents the outcome of the measurement. Okay, I think I was writing that as y before. And in this particular case, you can do the integral. And the integral gives you the following. It gives you a Gaussian distribution in theta 0, centered about some value theta 0 hat. And in this particular case, theta 0 hat comes out exactly to be the position of the maximum of the likelihood function. So that's the same as the maximum likelihood estimator. Furthermore, the width of this Gaussian happens to be exactly the same as the standard deviation of the maximum likelihood estimate. So in this particular case, the numerical values come out the same as in the frequentist method, but the interpretation is really quite different. Remember, the idea is that this function now specifies my degree of belief as to where the parameter theta 0 is located. Now, the fact that we could do this integral in this case is a happy coincidence, because I've chosen such simple functions for this example. I mean, a Gaussian with a likelihood function and a constant prior for theta 1 and for theta 0. And so it happened to come out doable. In most cases, you cannot do this marginalization integral in closed form. You need a numerical method. And I want to mention the most important numerical method for doing such integrals, which is based on Markov chain Monte Carlo. And the idea behind this is the following. In Bayesian computation, you very often will have many parameters, not just two. And you're only interested in some small subset. And so the dimensionality of this integral can be quite high. It will be completely impossible in closed form. And it's very often impossible even using normal Monte Carlo techniques. You're probably familiar with this acceptance rejection method for Monte Carlo. And you know that as the number of dimensions increases, the probability to accept an event can become vanishingly small. And so the normal acceptance rejection Monte Carlo technique is also usually not applicable in these problems. And so something called Markov chain Monte Carlo, or MCMC, has completely revolutionized Bayesian computation. There's a huge literature on this. If you Google for MCMC or Metropolis Hastings, you'll find out a lot more. What this algorithm does is it generates a correlated sequence of random numbers in this space of parameters. And so because the points that you generate are correlated, neighboring points are correlated, they cannot be used for many of the applications of random numbers that you might have in mind. For example, if you write a detector Monte Carlo program, you generate one random number to tell you what the momentum of a particle is, and then the next random number tells you something about how much ionization is created, and so forth. If you had a correlation between successive random numbers, that would ruin things completely. But on the other hand, if what you're just trying to do is an integral, you're just simply trying to count the fraction of points that are in some specified region, then the order of those points is irrelevant. And so for doing the types of integrals that we're dealing with here, this correlation is not a big problem. It does mean that when you go to compute the statistical error of your final result due to the fact that you have a finite number of Monte Carlo points, it's bigger than it would be if the points had been uncorrelated. So, good, I have time now to show you something about how this works. First let me show you the result. So that's what I did, is I wrote a little Monte Carlo, Markov chain Monte Carlo program that simply generated this sequence of points in the parameter space theta 0 versus theta 1. And if you look carefully at this, you can see that these points are slightly correlated, because you see here that they're a bit clustered. They're more clustered than you would normally expect in a Monte Carlo program. So what's happening is that you're marching around from point to point in this space. And then the parameter of interest is theta 0. So we simply project these points onto the theta 0 axis, and the width of that distribution tells me that distribution then gives me my final answer. That distribution is my posterior probability density for theta 0. Now, I think I have time, so I want to explain a little bit more about how this MCMC algorithm actually works. And so the idea is the following. Suppose you have some n-dimensional PDF, P of theta, and what you want to do now is to generate this sequence of points, theta 1, theta 2, theta 3, and so forth. So each one of these points is an n-dimensional point. The way the algorithm works is the following. You start at some initial point, right? And then what you need is a probability density called a proposal density, Q. And so the idea is that Q is a probability density for this n-dimensional space theta, but it contains as a parameter the current point where you are at. So, for example, to generate the first value of theta from the proposal density, you would use the initial point, theta 0, as the parameter. And one of the most commonly used proposal densities is simply a Gaussian, say, in theta, centered about theta 0. All right? So you generate a point theta from this proposal density, all right, which has as its parameter the previous point theta 0. Then in the next step, you form what is called the Hastings test ratio, alpha. And that is given by this quantity here. It is the minimum of 1 or this ratio. So here I've got the ratio of the two of the target density at the proposed point divided by the target density at the initial point. And there I've got the ratio of the proposal densities. And you notice here the arguments are flipped. All right? Okay, so I get this Hastings test ratio alpha. The next step, I generate a uniformly distributed random number between 0 and 1. And then I say, if this uniformly distributed random number is less than or equal to the Hastings test ratio, I step to the new point. Right? I take as theta 1, I take the proposed point. Otherwise, I take the old point again. So I hop in place. That's a little bit different from the normal acceptance rejection Monte Carlo, where if you reject, you chuck it completely. Here, if you don't accept, you repeat the old point. Which seems a little strange, but it works. Right? Now, that I guess I've already said. Let me make the following point, and that is very often one chooses for the proposal density something which is symmetric in the two arguments. And the Gaussian would be an example of that, right? A Gaussian is symmetric in the random variable argument and the point about which it is centered. And so if that symmetry holds, then in the... then that quantity there cancels from the Hastings test ratio. And then what you get is something called the Metropolis-Hastings algorithm. And so basically what this says is the following, is that you propose a point, all right? And then if you look at this ratio, look, if it says that if the probability of the proposed point is higher than the probability of the point where you're sitting, well then that ratio is going to be bigger than 1, and so therefore alpha is equal to 1. And so that means that you definitely accept the proposed point. You go to the new point. On the other hand, if alpha is less than 1, then you would go to the new point only with probability alpha. Otherwise, you hop in place. So that's the Metropolis-Hastings algorithm. Now, actually, you can only prove that sequence of points follows the target density in the limit that it runs forever. And furthermore, if the initial point is far removed from the concentration of probability of the density, you can show that there's a sort of a burn-in period where the sequence of points that you generate does not actually follow the target density. So sometimes people try to first do a sort of burn-in period until the point is well inside the concentrated region of the target density, and then they throw away the burn-in period. Unfortunately, there are very few useful theorems that tell you exactly how much of that sequence you should regard as the burn-in period and how long of a sequence you need in order to ensure that this sequence of points has explored the entire probability density. You can look at trace plots, that is to say, you can look at values of the generated points versus the step. You can look at how correlated they are, pairs of points that are separated by a specified lag. The function that you can use for the proposal density, there are very few restrictions on what function you can use. So you could try a multivariate Gaussian, or you could try something with longer tails. If you think that you have the right answer, what you can do is you can try starting from widely different points and look and see if you get the same answer. And some of the important convergence criteria that people use are basically based on that idea, starting the calculation from widely different starting points and simply comparing looking at the dispersion in the different answers that you obtain. So here's now an example of where you would need that MCMC technology. Suppose instead of having a simple Gaussian prior for theta 1, I had something more complicated. So instead of having a previous a measurement that related to theta 1, suppose some theorist has said, well, I am a theorist. I have some sense of where this parameter theta 1 should be. And the theorist pulls out a cocktail napkin and sketches some curve. And they might say, well, we know it has to be positive. And we think that its value should be less than, I don't know, what did I say here, 0.1. And perhaps the curve that this theorist sketches on the cocktail napkin looks kind of exponential-like. So you might say, well, all right, I will take as my prior probability for theta 1 an exponential in theta 1 with some width tau, where tau is like 0.1. In that case, you can no longer do the integral closed form, but you can do it with Markov chain Monte Carlo. And if you do, that is then the posterior density that you wind up with. And here I've shown it for several different values of the width of this exponential, 0.1, 0.01, 0.001. Okay. You can see that that makes sense. If I flick back if you knew that the slope of that line was very small, then you would think that the y-intercept would have to be higher. Okay, so that's from an exponential prior. In addition, one would typically try to look at different priors as well. Now, I should emphasize that this idea of varying the prior in a Bayesian analysis is an important part of any Bayesian analysis. Remember that Bayes' theorem only tells you how your degree of belief should be updated in the light of the data. It makes no specific, it has no unique recipe for these prior probabilities. So therefore, if you want to publish a result which is of value to the broader community and not only to that person who has that particular prior belief, then you have to show what the posterior probabilities would look like for some variety of prior probabilities. Right, so now, how much time do I have? Do I have another? Okay, I can do this in 10 minutes. I can do it in 7 minutes. That's probably a lie. Okay, let me, final example. Suppose now we generalize the example a little bit, and I said that suppose I have measured values yi, and I have some statistical errors, sigma I statistical, and in addition, for each measured point, I have a systematic error. Now, in fact, usually if you have a set of measurements, you also might have correlations between the different points, and people might actually specify a full covariance matrix, the covariance between yi and yj, and also a systematic covariance between yi and yj for every pair of points. Right? Now, suppose I have now the predicted value for this measurement, mu of xi, which depends on some set of parameters theta. But now I want to say this in a slightly different way. I want to say that the expectation value of my measurement is not necessarily equal to the predicted value, but might include some bias term. I can simply take that equation as my definition of what I mean by a bias. A bias is the expectation value in my measurement minus the thing I'm using to try to predict it. Now, how would you normally treat this problem in a frequentist analysis? Well, what people very often do is to add the systematic and statistical errors in quadrature. That corresponds to simply adding the statistical and systematic covariance matrices. And then you would simply take that full covariance matrix and you would use it to construct a chi-squared-like quantity. Normally in the chi-squared, you're used to seeing that sum of squares, but if there are correlations, then in matrix, here I've used this matrix notation to write the corresponding chi-squared. Here I have to think of y and mu as a row vector. Here it's a column vector, and so the transpose is a row vector. So that would be my formula for the chi-squared. Okay, so minimizing this chi-squared would be equivalent to maximizing the likelihood function, at least in the case if the data are Gaussian distributed. All right, so here would be now the Bayesian equivalent to that procedure. Well, let me comment first. Why simply add the statistical and systematic errors in quadrature? What is the formal justification for doing that? Well, so if we look at the Bayesian procedure, we'll at least see that there is some nominal justification for that step. In the Bayesian approach, what you would do is the following. Is you would say that the likelihood function only involves the statistical errors, because the likelihood function is what is telling you how the data would be distributed upon repetition of the experiment. All right? And so the likelihood function would be, say, some Gaussian distribution for y, but it would only involve the statistical part of the covariance matrix. Notice here that the measurements are distributed about the predicted value and the bias. Right? Now, these bias values, this B vector represents the set of all these bias parameters. They are nuisance parameters then. And they would have also some prior probability density. And since I have been given these systematic errors, that is exactly what the width of the distribution for these bias parameters is supposed to represent. All right, the prior distribution for the parameters B could be a Gaussian distribution centered about zero, but with a width reflected by the systematic covariance matrix. And as before, I could take something relatively constant for the parameters of interest. I put those ingredients into Bayes' theorem, and that gives me the joint probability density for the parameters of interest and the bias parameters given the measurement. That's proportional to this likelihood function times the prior, right? That's Bayes' theorem. And then to get the desired probability for the parameter of interest, I simply integrate that joint probability density over the bias parameters. And what you find in this particular case is that the posterior density for the parameter of interest is a Gaussian function with a peak exactly the same as the position of the least squares estimator in the case where you add the systematic and statistical errors in quadrature. So it looks like we're back where we started. And that fact that the two answers agree gives you a sort of formal justification for adding systematic and statistical errors in quadrature. But what's nice about the Bayesian approach is the following. This allows you to generalize the procedure to the case where you might not want to consider a Gaussian distribution as the appropriate prior probability density for these bias parameters. Now, a Gaussian distribution has tails that fall off extremely quickly. And in many cases, you might have a degree of belief function for those systematic biases which does not fall off so quickly. This comes up particularly in cases where a systematic error itself has an error. Some systematic errors are at best good guesses, and you could regard an error on the error as at least 10% or 20% or 50%, and in many cases that's perfectly realistic. So what you could have instead of a Gaussian distribution for your prior is some sort of a Gaussian, but where the width of that Gaussian is multiplied by a scale factor, and then you have some sort of a density for that scale factor, which might be centered about 1, but which would have some width. So this expression here represents a mixture of Gaussians of different widths. All right? So if this pi s of s, the scale factor s, if that was a delta function at 1, then this would simply be a Gaussian distribution with a width given by the sigma I sys. But if this function there, which I'll say has a standard deviation sigma s, that sigma s represents the error on the error. Okay? And you can see here's what that curve looks like on a log scale for different values of the error on the error. If I have no error on the error, then it's just a parabola, which means that it's on a log scale. That's just a Gaussian distribution. But if I have a 50% error on the error, then you get tails which are much, much longer. Right? So that's the kind of generalization to the problem that you can make in the Bayesian approach, for which there would be no simple way of making this generalization in the frequentist approach. Yeah?
About bias?
Yes?
B and then scale factor.
Yeah. Okay, so the bias, what I mean by the bias, God, I keep on going the wrong way. What I mean by the bias is simply the expectation value of the measurement minus my predicted value. All right? If that is a quantity which might be zero or it might be non-zero if my model is uncertain. So I'm going to take that parameter B as an unknown parameter. All right, so that's what I mean by the bias. If I knew a non-zero value for that bias, I would include it in my model, and it would no longer be a bias. That is to say, if you have a systematic correction that you can make, well, then you make that correction, and it's no longer a systematic error. Here, the idea is that I don't know what the value of B is, but I have to allow for the possibility that it could be non-zero. I have to allow for the possibility that the expectation value of my measurement might not be equal to the predicted value. So that's what I mean by the bias. Now, what I mean here is the following, is that I want to write down the prior probability density for that bias. In the previous example, what I did is I simply wrote down a Gaussian. And if somebody tells you, my systematic error is such and such, normally what you have in mind is that there should be some sort of, that's a Gaussian distributed error. Right? But now I simply want to allow for the possibility that there's an error on the error. All right. When somebody told me the error was plus or minus 1, maybe he meant to say plus or minus 0.8 or plus or minus 1.2, because the error itself was somehow uncertain. And so this is simply a way of motivating a non-Gaussian shape for the prior probability density for the bias. All right. So this function here, actually in this example, I took it happened to be a gamma distribution. It's a distribution which was centered about 1, which had some width, sigma s. All right. And then I simply did these integrals numerically, and those are the curves that come out. you don't have to use that motivation to get these curves. All I wanted to do was say that one does not always have to consider a Gaussian form for the prior probability density for these biases. It can be perfectly reasonable to choose a non-Gaussian form. And considering the error on the error is one possible motivation for choosing a non-Gaussian form. Okay. So let's do, finally, let me finish up now and just do this example. If we take, for example, the statistical and systematic errors to be 0.1, I invent some measurements, there are my measured points, bing, 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 all right? This could be, for example, where you want to average the results from, say, four different experiments that have all measured the same quantity. So here's the measured result for four different experiments. That could be the four left experiments, for example. Now, what I would do is I would put these ingredients into Bayes' theorem, and what I would get then is the posterior probability density for the mean value mu given the four measurements y. All right? And so that is the posterior density that I would get. And instead of actually giving this function, typically what you would give is the peak position and the standard deviation, the width. So let me show this now for two cases. In the first case, I consider the case where the error on the error was zero. That corresponded to the Gaussian PDF for the biases. And you get a certain value and you get a certain error. Here's the case where I get a 50% error on the error. So that corresponded to the much broader prior probability for the bias parameters. But in this case, that doesn't change the estimated value, and it only increases the error a slight amount, very slight amount. The two curves, you cannot distinguish here. They're basically on top of each other. So it wouldn't matter in this case. But that's because all these points lined up pretty well, which I made happen. But what can happen, for example, if one of the four measurements happens to be a bit of an outlier? It happens to depart substantially from the other guys. What you see then is in the case where you consider a Gaussian PDF for the bias parameters, that the peak position of that posterior from mu is pulled substantially to the right. But interestingly, the error, the width of that curve, does not change at all. All right? But that seems a little odd, but nevertheless, that is what comes out of it. On the other hand, if you consider a 50% error on the error, which is to say that you allow for a non-Gaussian tail in the prior for these biases, then you notice a couple of things. First of all, you notice that the peak position is not pulled so far to the right? So the average value is not pulled up so much by this outlier. Furthermore, the fact that there is an outlier inflates the width of the posterior. So instead, you notice that the error has gone up quite a bit. So this is wider. Both of those things are actually, I think, desirable features. One is that you're less sensitive to the presence of an outlier. Furthermore, if you do have an outlier, it tells you that there's an additional uncertainty. And that should be reflected in the width of your posterior distribution. Okay, so the Bayesian fit with this particular prior is much less sensitive to the outlier. That's an important feature. That's basically shown in this plot here, but since I'm out of time, I think I don't have to discuss that. So let me just conclude. The distinctive features of a Bayesian analysis are that we use subjective probability for hypotheses, for example, for the value of a parameter. Bayes' theorem tells you how to relate the probability for data given the hypothesis to the probability of the hypothesis given the data. So in that sense, it represents a sort of learning. Right? What that requires, however, in Bayes' theorem are prior probabilities for the hypotheses. And there's no golden rule for how to supply those. Now, in many cases, particularly when there's a lot of information in the data, the Bayesian methods reveal answers which are very close numerically to the answers that you would get from a frequentist analysis. And so when that's the case, then there's no real controversy. There may be a different philosophical interpretation of the final results, but as long as the numbers agree, there's not too much of a controversy. That's not the case, however, when there's prior information present which is important relative to the information contained in the data. Okay, so I'll stop there.
Thank you. which in a sense forces Freud to say, well, I have now to put an element of uncertainty.
It is definitely true that there's a subjective element as to how
conservative or non-conservative you want to be in assigning uncertainties. Sometimes the uncertainty, a systematic uncertainty, is perfectly well defined. For example, if you have used Monte Carlo to compute some integral, and that Monte Carlo run has a certain finite length, effectively that systematic uncertainty is like a statistical uncertainty, and its value is very well defined. In other cases, you might have a theoretical uncertainty from QCD due to the renormalization scale, or something you would associate with the renormalization scale. And if you ask one theorist, they'll say, well, vary the renormalization scale by this much, and some other theorist tells you a different value. So that's a typical, those are situations where you would definitely have an uncertainty on the uncertainty. Now, as for places where the experimentalists' own somehow conservatism or not interest might be in the modeling of their own detector, then again, I think you would find a spectrum of results. Some people are more conservative than others. But I think we would agree that there are definitely important cases where the value that is reported for a systematic uncertainty itself has some sort of uncertainty. And that can be equivalent to saying that the uncertainty in the corresponding parameter has a non-Gaussian tail. Right. I thought I skipped over that quite quickly. Let me.
Very quickly, actually, I didn't.
All right, hang on.
What you were saying.
Let me get to where was it? One more. Come on. There. So the idea would be the following: was that in your initial measurement, this was the likelihood function for the two parameters theta 0 and theta 1, and I said that each measurement y was a Gaussian distributed quantity. And so that means that the likelihood function there is simply my product of Gaussian terms. So that would be my ordinary likelihood function, and the measured quantities there are these yi. Now I say I have an additional measurement, t1. All right? T1 is a Gaussian distributed quantity centered about theta 1. All right? And it's independent. So if measurements are independent, that means their probabilities just multiply. So that's the kind of a point that I skipped over. But that means that the full likelihood function would simply get another term as a product, a multiplicative term. Sigma t1, the width of the measurement for t1, e to the minus t1 minus theta 1 squared over 2 sigma t1 squared. Right. Okay? And so that's now my new full likelihood function. That's what you would do if you have a new independent measurement t1. Now if I take the full log likelihood function, what happens when you take the log is that sum, that product gets converted to a sum, and what you get is the sum of those guys. And then similarly, that is also part of the product, so it just becomes an additive term, and that exponential goes away. Sorry, yeah. So there's two groups involved in that. There's UT fit and CKM fitter, and CKM fitter, I guess, that's the frequentist one. And so yes, in both Bayesian and frequentist analyses, you have to construct a likelihood function. So this idea of trying to put together a model for the probability of the data given the parameters, that occurs in both. Then the difference between the frequentist and Bayesian schools would simply be, if you're a frequentist, you simply regard as your estimators for those parameters the values which maximize the likelihood. All right. Whereas if you're a Bayesian, you take this likelihood and you put it into Bayes' theorem. There's another question. Yeah. Yeah. I think what's More mysterious is why, if you don't include the error on the error, the having an outlier has no influence on the width of the posterior distribution. So, let's see. The thing that we want to explain, if I understood your question correctly, is that if you have an error on the error, it gets broader. And you want to know, is there some intuitive way of understanding that?
Now the question is, I mean, is there, let's say, strict treatment of this? I mean, does it just correspond to our intuition? Or is it just a choice I have to make here if I want to include the error on the error or not?
So exactly. In other words, you're saying why, under what circumstances should you choose something with an error on the error, and under what circumstances should you not? That boils down to the choice of your prior probability for certain parameters in the problem. And so no, there is no fundamental rule that tells you what those prior probabilities should be. You could ask, for example, why did people pick a Gaussian in the first place? Why do people regard uncertainties as something that's Gaussian distributed? You can attribute that to the central limit theorem, because you can say that if the reason why a true value departs from the value that you think it is, if that's the due to a sum of a large number of small disturbances, then what the central limit theorem tells you is that that uncertainty should form a Gaussian, a distribution. On the other hand, if there can be factors which give you a large uncertainty, then those can lead to very non-Gaussian tails. From the standpoint of the Bayesian statistics, I think the answer to your question is going to be no, there is not a formal way of seeing why you should have long tails. That is part of this subjective element of the analysis.
Is it possible to use the Bayes theorem as a recurrent relation? I mean,
no. Yeah, good question. No. Yeah. Okay. So that's a good one. Let me flip to the last slide and address that. Okay. So you could think perhaps the following, that. At first, I don't know anything, or I'm not even sure what I should put down for my prior probabilities. But I choose something, perhaps something very diffuse, something very broad. And then I do my experiment, and I get these posterior probabilities, the probability for h given x. And then you could think to yourself, well, actually, that would have been better to use as my prior, because after all, that's what I think now, and so therefore it would have been something good to have thought then. And so therefore I take that and I stick it back in. And then you iterate, for example. And if you do that, basically what you find is that you get all of your posterior probability would be concentrated about the result of the experiment that you got. So, for example, your likelihood function would have a maximum for a certain value of the parameter, and your eventual posterior density would be a delta function at that value. All right? So, no, that's not what Bayes' theorem tells you to do. I don't know if exactly that's what you were suggesting, but A lot of people come to that sort of conclusion, and I think if you think about it for a bit, you realize it's just wrong. That's not what Bayes' theorem is telling you to do.
How do you interpret the results of the analysis if you find a very small prior difference?
It means that very little information is coming in from your data, and that your posterior beliefs are being strongly influenced by your prior beliefs. And you can detect that that is true in a Bayesian analysis, because you will see a strong dependence of your posterior probabilities on the prior, and that is then very good to realize. It means that you somehow have that information up front. The same thing can be true, or the analogous thing can be true in a frequentist analysis, in that perhaps the results that you get can be very dependent on the model that you choose, how you write down the likelihood function. But in that case, it might not be so simple to uncover that sensitivity. Right? So the fact that a sensitivity on the prior can be detected in a Bayesian analysis can be seen as a good thing.
So that paper. Wait.
sure, yeah.
And he tried to publish it, and it got rejected.